well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Daniel Schmutter, firearms attorney in New Jersey, lead counsel for the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, in its challenge to New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, a lawsuit that was combined with a couple of other challenges to the same law, and of course the Third Circuit coming out and declaring both the gun ban and magazine ban a violation of our Second Amendment rights, at least when it comes to the semi-automatic rifles that were covered under New Jersey's quote-unquote assault weapons ban. They said they're going to leave it up to the lower court to figure out if the shotguns and handguns that are also covered under the ban on so-called assault weapons also violates the Second Amendment. But it's pretty clear based on the Third Circuit's decision that, yes, those items are also going to be protected by the Second Amendment. This was a huge decision. You know, it creates a circuit court split on the issue of gun bans. Actually, the First Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Massachusetts' ban on so-called assault weapons yesterday in an opinion that largely cites a precedent from last year. And one that was wrongly decided, obviously, but one that completely ignored the text, history, and tradition test laid out by the Supreme Court. The Third Circuit did not. You know, we've talked before about the majority opinion authored by a Joe Biden-appointed judge that actually did respect what the Supreme Court has said about how you determine whether or not a modern gun law is constitutional. And a lot of lower courts have either ignored outright what the Supreme Court has said, they've twisted and manipulated what the Supreme Court has said. Third Circuit didn't do that. They actually took the Supreme Court at face value, and they determined that, yes, AR-15s, other semi-automatic rifles that are declared assault weapons under New Jersey law, are in fact in common use for lawful purposes, as are the ammunition magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds that the state of New Jersey has banned. So again, a supremely important decision, even with the Supreme Court already agreeing to hear a challenge to the semi-auto bans in Cook County, Illinois, and in the state of Connecticut. Daniel Schmutter has a lot to say about the Third Circuit decision, as well as, again, what happens next. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Thanks so much for having me, Cam.
Yeah, and congratulations. I mean, honestly, this was a huge win in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And, you know, can you tell me your reaction when you saw that this opinion had come out and when you started reading what the en banc panel had to say?
Thanks, Cam. We're very, very happy. I was ecstatic. It's a magnificent decision. Obviously, we would like to have we would like the court to have also addressed the shotgun and pistol issues at the same time, but that's okay. We'll go back. You know, we're going to go back to the district court and finish up those claims. But the legal framework that the Third Circuit provided for us to do so is really wonderful, and it's a very strong opinion, and it really deals with the issues in a very crisp, clean way that really helps folks understand exactly how the Second Amendment is supposed to work and how it's supposed to be applied in arms bans like this. And it's very, very strong. We're very, very happy.
You know, you talk about that crisp, clean assessment here. And, you know, when you look back at some of the rulings that have upheld bans on so-called assault weapons, the Fourth Circuit's opinion, for example, you know, this tortured logic about, well, the arms aren't even protected by the Second Amendment because they're like machine guns. But even if they were protected by the Second Amendment, they're dangerous, unusually dangerous. And therefore, you know, they're not in common use, no matter how many guns might be owned. This cuts through all of that clutter, right? I mean, it is very simple and elegant in its simplicity. Are these arms in common use for lawful purposes, and not just self-defense, but for lawful purposes? And if so, they can't be dangerous, and unusual, right? Those two things are mutually exclusive, according to this opinion.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting because people will sometimes be annoyed or be aggravated that courts will sometimes hold opinions pending a Supreme Court decision that might be relevant or influential on what the lower court is going to do. But in this case, the Third Circuit made very good use of the Wolford decision. As we were waiting for this, you know, we're thinking to ourselves, well, you know, because we have two major cases that were at the Third Circuit on bonk that we were waiting for. This was the first. The second one is the sense of place cases, Coons and Siegel. But, you know, you think to yourself, well, you know, is the courts, you know, explicitly waiting for the Supreme Court to rule so that it can incorporate those principles into its decision? Or is it simply taking this much time for the court to get the opinions written and done? And, you know, you don't know for sure in any given case. But here, the court really made good use of Wolford in setting forth each of these principles in their crisp, clean form. You know, one of the things that one of the takeaways from Wolford, in my view, is how the Supreme Court really clarified the simplicity of things like step one of Bruin. you know, the way the court laid out the very simple, straightforward approach to step one, because, you know, a number of courts have tried to use step one as a way to reject Second Amendment claims, and they've tried to sort of smuggle in a history inquiry into step one that doesn't belong there. And Wolford, by clarifying that and saying, you know, step one is fairly simple. First you go to the people, then you go to what an arm is, then you go to keep and bear, and that's it. You don't have complex analyses of what an arm was back then. Is it an arm? Yes. Move on to the next step, and that really helps here because the Third Circuit had previously held, for example, on the magazine portion of the case, had previously held that magazines were arms. But the way in which other courts and hostile courts have tried to manipulate step one and manipulate what's an arm, are semi-automatic rifles like AR-15s arms, or are they not arms because they're, you know, more like military weapons? It's this way to manipulate the Bruin rubric to defeat these claims where they should prevail. So the fact that Wolford laid things out so nicely and crisply, and the Third Circuit was able to piggyback off of Wolford to issue a very crisp and clean opinion here, it's very, very interesting and helpful.
Absolutely. You know, and then we get into the common use test, right? And, you know, as I mentioned, there are some courts that say, well, I mean, it can't just be about how many guns are owned. That can't be the metric by which we judge whether a gun's in common use. There are some courts that have said, well, okay, well, it has to be in common use for self-defense. You know, they don't care about, you know, hunting or recreational shooting. It has to be in common use for self-defense or else it's not protected, which is a really weird reading that would, you know, exclude bolt action rifles, right? Hunting shotguns out of the Second Amendment entirely. We've been told for decades those are the only guns that might be protected by the Second Amendment. What was the Third Circuit's a rationale or argument for, you know, this is what common use means?
Well, they went straight to Heller. I mean, that's really all you have to do. That, you know, one of the problems here, Cam, is that the courts that are hostile to Heller and Bruin just sort of play games with those rulings. It's not that hard. You go to Heller and you see that what Heller says, and the way they explain it is very simple. The tradition of common use comes from the fact, and this is the court's only citation to the Miller case in Heller, is that the arms that are protected were typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. And the reason for that is because at the time of the militia, when ordinary people were called to muster for militia service, they brought with them whatever they had. And whatever they had in their homes was what was in common use at the time. So it's a very simple concept. It's what people had in their homes, because the people get to decide what arms to keep and bear, not the state. The state doesn't get to decide what's appropriate for keeping and bearing. It's the people. It's the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And that's what the common use test is. It's simply a recognition that people get to choose the arms for keeping and bearing under their fundamental right. And so when courts can't embrace that, when the hostile courts can't embrace that, they come up with all these ways to twist the concept of the simple concept of common use. And so they say things like, well, it has to be in common use for self-defense. And that means we have to count trigger pulls. Right. So some courts, including some of the states, including the state of New Jersey, have tried to argue that you have to count, and they produced experts to testify at trial on these things. Well, you have to count the number of times people use these weapons to engage in self-defense. Well, we all know that the actual number of times people squeeze the trigger in self-defense is a very small number. It's not about how many times you squeeze the trigger. It's why you possess the arm. People choose these arms for a very clear reason, because they are extremely useful, they're extremely beneficial, they're easy to use, they are available to people for all sorts of lawful purposes that are beneficial to their needs. And so the key is, why do people choose them? And who's choosing them? Ordinary people, ordinary citizens, ordinary individuals, for all sorts of lawful purposes, including self-defense, including hunting, as the Third Circuit recognizes, including all sorts of purposes. The point is, people get to choose. Law-abiding people get to choose the arms they want to keep and bear. And as long as people are keeping and bearing them for lawful purposes, they're protected because they're in common use. And you have to, these hostile states like New Jersey and these hostile courts have to bend over backwards to try to twist the reasoning and the analysis, because if they just look at it the way the Supreme Court explained it in Heller and in Bruin and in other cases, they're not going to be able to uphold these laws. So they have to engage in these gymnastics.
Well, yeah, I think you're right about that. And, we see this, too, when it comes to the historical analogs. Right. And the Seventh Circuit, just before the Third Circuit released this decision, they released their opinion upholding Illinois' ban on, so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And they base that largely off of 19th century laws surrowning Bowie knives, right? This was another analog that the state of New Jersey had offered, and laws regulating slung shots and things of that nature. The Third Circuit said, well, those weren't in common use, but they also said the timeline doesn't match up, right? I guess There's this debate back and forth about, well, is it 1791? Is it 1868? What's the appropriate time period? Is it both? The Third Circuit has come down pretty squarely and said 1791, right? That's the most important time period in question. So for the Third Circuit, these Bowie knife bans, and there were only a handful of outright bans. I mean, there were a lot of, carry regulations and things of that nature. But they said, those come too late in time, and they were not as all-encompassing as New Jersey's ban. When you see the Seventh Circuit say, well, no, this matters, this is an appropriate analog, the Third Circuit says, no, it's not. I mean, obviously, I know who you think has the better argument, but I'm curious how courts like the Seventh Circuit can get away with pointing to these regulations on knives when we didn't see any of these types of prohibitions on the Winchester repeating rifle, which I think was the AR-15 of its day. Right. How broadly can the courts actually draw these analogies where regulations on a knife in the 1840s is somehow akin to banning the possession or banning the sale of a semi-automatic rifle in 2026?
Well, it's particularly frustrating because, and this is some of this is due to the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't come right out and said it's 1791. As you correctly noted, in the Third Circuit, it's 1791. The Third Circuit said so in a case called Lara and reiterated it here in this case. So here, it's 1791. When you look at what the Supreme Court says in Bruin, they basically come out and say it's 1791. They pretend that they haven't said it, but they've ruled that the Second Amendment and constitutional provisions generally in the Bill of Rights are not different for the federal government versus state governments. So the only way for that to really be true is for it to be 1791, because for federal law, it's clearly 1791, because the 14th Amendment has nothing to do with federal law. So the only way for that to actually work is for state law to have to comply with the historical tradition in and about 1791 at the time of the founding. So, you know, we all know that it's 1791, but the Supreme Court just for some reason has decided not to come out and say it. But all, you know, these hostile states like New Jersey and California and Maryland and Hawaii, et cetera, all they've got is mid to late 18th century stuff to present to these courts. You know, when we litigate these cases, we get these, you know, when the state of New Jersey and other states present their papers to the court, they get these, they have these large appendices that lay out all these different laws. They're all from mid to late 18th century or 19th century. And sometimes into the 20th century, because there really were no significant regulations at the time of the founding. They weren't restricting the right to keep bear arms in the ways that these states want to do it. And so they know that if it's 1791, they're going to lose most of these cases. And so they've got to hang on some fiction that these later laws somehow matter. And then what they do is they pick these outliers. First of all, they pick, and Bruin clearly precluded that stuff. And the Third Circuit did a wonderful job of explaining why, number one, the tradition has to be widespread, meaning you need a broad spectrum of analogs. You can't just pick and choose a law here or a law there. It's got to be a broad tradition. So traditions have to be longstanding and broad. So you need a large number of states. You can't use these territories that, you know, these pre-state territories that have all sorts of laws. Bruin explains why you don't just pick some Western territory that had some wacky law before it became a state. And you don't pick an outlier, and you don't pick untimely laws. So we're, you know, the fact that these Bowie knife laws don't show up until, you know, the mid 19th century is an enormous factor in why they don't work. And as you correctly pointed out, they're not bans for the most part. So you can't even use an analog of a law that wasn't a ban to support a ban. That doesn't fit the how aspect of the Bruin analysis for analogs. So it's all they've got to go on. So they desperately try to bring these kinds of laws in, and courts like the Third Circuit have thankfully recognized it doesn't work.
Thankfully, which brings us to, I guess, the real world implications here, Dan. The New Jersey State Police, this is, you know, kind of gone around on social media, sent a message to, I believe it was a gun store in New Jersey, saying we think the effective date for this is going to be July 31st. John Petrolino has a piece of Bearing Arms Today. He reached out to the Attorney General's office and the AG's office said they also think that this will essentially take effect as of July 31st. Have you heard, first of all, whether or not the state of New Jersey plans to appeal this decision? And based on your understanding, you know, is this order going to come down in the next couple of days? Will the ban be off the books here in, you know, let's say at the end of July?
So maybe some discussion of the nuts and bolts of how this stuff works might be helpful for your audience, Cam. So I'm not sure why they picked July 31st for their position as to when this becomes effective. It might be that there's 14 days to seek reconsideration or rehearing, really. And so July 31st is 14 days from the July 17th decision. So they may have set heat on that date as the date that their opportunity to seek rehearing expires. But realistically, what ought to happen here, or what I expect to happen here, is first of all, when a court of appeals decision isn't automatically self-enforcing. What happens is the court of appeals issues what's called a mandate, and the mandate is the actual order, the direction to the lower court to implement the ruling. The mandate, according to the clerk's office, I spoke to them. The clerk's office says the mandate is expected to issue August 10th. So if that's the case, what I would expect to happen is the mandate would issue on August 10th. We meaning the attorneys in the case, would then likely hear from the district judge. And the district judge will probably ask the attorneys to discuss a form of order or judgment. Because remember, in order for this to be implemented, you need an injunction. You need a permanent injunction. That's what we as the plaintiffs sought. We filed our complaints in the district court asking for relief. And the relief that we asked for was twofold. Number one, an injunction precluding the state of New Jersey from enforcing these laws, and a declaratory judgment declaring them unconstitutional. The actual injunction typically comes from the district court. So what the Third Circuit has done is analyzed the law, ruled on the law and the facts, and instructed the district court, essentially instructing the district court to do things in a certain way with the case. So what I would expect to happen, as I said, the district court is likely to once the mandate issues, the district court is likely to reach out to us and probably will have us on a conference call or whatever and say, okay, I'd like counsel to agree on a form of order and then submit it to me, the district judge, for signature. That's typically how this stuff goes. So that's what I would expect to happen. And presumably once because here's the thing, the parties, not just the state of New Jersey, but also the plaintiffs and the people that we represent, you know, the members of the organizations and other people who benefit from this ruling, need to know specifically what is prohibited and what is not prohibited. That is, what can the state enforce and what can the state not enforce? And, you know, a 60-some-odd page ruling is great, but it's not crisp and concrete enough necessarily for people to know exactly, oh, I can do this, I can't do that. That's what the district court's judgment or order does. It lays out the specifics of what is enjoined, what is not enjoined, what the ruling specifically says as a matter of the relief that the parties have obtained.
Okay,
that's where I think the rubber meets the road. Once the actual permanent injunction is signed by the district court, that's really where we'll know, okay, now the state of New Jersey is prohibited from enforcing these statutory provisions as listed in the injunction. That's how, okay, I would expect this to go.
You know, okay, which, so the Third Circuit, as you mentioned, they said, listen, we hold that these rifles are protected by the Second Amendment. We're going to leave it up to the district court to do the analysis on the shotguns and the handguns that are covered under the same law. Do we have to wait for the district court to do that analysis before we get the injunction barring enforcement of the assault weapon ban, quote unquote, as it applies to the rifles and the magazines?
No, there should be no reason for that.
The
issue relating to magazines and rifles has been decided by the Third Circuit. The district judge is now obligated, or will be once the mandate issues, obligated to follow that and enter the appropriate relief. So what I believe should happen is the district judge should reach out to the attorneys and ask us two things. As I said, to settle a form of judgment as to the rifles and magazines, which she should, you know, enter, you know, soon, but then also probably do some sort of scheduling conference where the court will say, okay, how long do you need to, you know, do you need to amend your complaint? Do you need to, you know, is there some additional discovery you need? Do you want to file a motion? So we'll lay out, presumably there will be a schedule for the finishing up the rest of the case. So they should proceed separately. We ought to be entitled to a permanent injunction now, and then the rest of the case will proceed according to some schedule that will be discussed presumably with the attorneys, and we'll discuss it with the district judge and move that case forward.
Okay. Last question for you, Dan. You mentioned Kuhn Siegel, the Sensitive Places lawsuit, the Third Circuit heard oral arguments en banc, around the same time that they heard oral arguments in the assault weapon and magazine ban case. Do you anticipate that decision coming out relatively soon, now that we've got the AWB decision?
We certainly hope so. That was argued a number of months later.
Oh, okay.
Again, there's no way to predict the order in which these cases are addressed, how many decisions are being drafted, you know, what kind of comments they get when they're circulated. You know, when you're dealing with, especially when you're dealing with the en banc court, for Kuhn and Siegel, it's the 14 active judges. This was 15 because the senior judge Smith was on the panel, the three-judge panel. So by rule, he was allowed to elect to be on the en banc panel. But for Kuhn and Siegel, there was no senior judge on the panel. So that's the 14 active judges. And, you know, when you have 14 judges, I mean, look at how many opinions were written in this case.
Right.
You have opinions, drafts going back and forth. And so who knows how long it takes. It would be great if we heard from the court soon, but there's no way to know, really. So we'd love to look. I'd love to see an opinion come out today, but we just don't know. But but one nice thing about this opinion, mm-hmm, is, number one, it establishes a really great understanding and application of the Second Amendment in the Third Circuit, and it also shows which judges in the en banc court understand the Second Amendment in what ways. So it's very encouraging because we now know how, you know, I mean, this was a 10-5 decision in our favor. So we now know that 10 judges seem to have a very clear way of understanding the Second Amendment. And so that bodes very well, hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, but that's very encouraging for Coons and Siegel, because it's the, other than the one senior judge, it's the same judges that have to decide Coons and Siegel. So we're hoping that they have the same kind of clear thinking in that case that they did here. So this is, it's very encouraging for that case as well.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that we get to have you back on the program very soon talking about the decision in Coons Siegel. And again, congratulations. This is such an important win for the Second Amendment and for New Jersey residents. Daniel Schmider, thanks for everything you do, sir. And thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much, Ken.
My thanks to Dan for joining us on the program and looking forward to talking to him in the future. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Tucson. The headline: suspect in downtown Tucson mass shooting still unavailable for court. 21-year-old David French arrested and charged in the shooting over the weekend that left 9 people injured. And as it turns out, young Mr. French, not a stranger to the criminal justice system, according to, this is a KOLD in Tucson, French has a prior conviction for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. According to an interim complaint in that case, French is accused of pointing a rifle at a man in October of 2024, ultimately firing that rifle once in the direction of the man, who was not hit. French admitted to officers that he was at the location, said he did not remember shooting anybody. Might have slipped my mind. French eventually, though, reached a deal to plead guilty to a count of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. He was sentenced to 4 years probation back in May of 2025. So, you know, again, this isn't just a possessory offense, right? This isn't, well, he was caught with a small amount of marijuana 2 years ago and he got probation. No, he shot at somebody. He missed, but he shot at somebody. And not in an act of self-defense. He admitted to aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. So why was he given nothing more than probation? KWLD says this is something that Tucson residents are concerned about. Todd Rathner, a longtime Second Amendment advocate in Arizona, says a guy like this belongs in jail. And if he was in jail, this crime would never have been committed. He says the entire judicial system treats these people as if they're kids who need a slap on the wrist. This guy didn't need a slap on the wrist. He needed a jail cell close behind him. Pima County Attorney Laura Conover said that their records check indicates that the individual was charged by her office, again, back in 2025 or 2024, with a Class 3 felony for firing a weapon during an altercation. He then pled guilty to that aggravated assault. At sentencing, he faced a prison range of anywhere from 2 to nearly 9 years in prison. The court's probation department assessed the individual and found him to meet the criteria for a sentence of intensive probation. And the judge ordered standard probation. It appears that he was still under that supervision in our community without any documented infractions in the court file when Sunday morning's incident occurred. Oh, well, I mean, you know, so I mean, he'd been abiding by the terms of his probation until he allegedly shot 9 people. Oopsie. So this does sound like this was a problem with the court system. If the sentencing range for this crime was anywhere from 2 years in prison to 9 years in prison, and he got 4 years probation, that is a downward departure, is it not? And again, I think Todd Rathner is correct about this. You know, the mayor of Tucson also has been talking about, well, you know, the availability of guns and blah, 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 it's gun control. The owner of the pizza restaurant where the shooting took place says, no, it's not about gun control. It's about a decline in public safety. In downtown Tucson in particular. But I think, again, you can look at the court system. And why on earth was somebody who was charged with a violent offense, who was able to plead, who was willing to plead guilty to this violent offense of shooting at somebody, walk away with nothing more than a couple of years of supervised probation? And it doesn't matter that, again, until this a recent arrest and these most recent charges, he had apparently been abiding by the terms of his probation. That's no longer the case, is it? So he was on probation for a little bit more than a year. 25% complete, right, his probationary sentence. And again, now he's charged with 9 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, as opposed to the 1 count he pleaded guilty to back in 2025. 9 counts of aggravated assault with serious physical injury, and a discharge in a firearm at a structure. More charges are possible as well. Rathner's right. This didn't need to have happened. This shouldn't have happened, because this guy should have been behind bars the first time he shot at somebody. Instead, he basically got away with it. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. From Idaho, no arrest made following deadly shooting in Bonner County residence. Now, the investigation does continue, but at this point, it really does sound like an act of self-defense. We will see if, the investigation turns up any additional details that might change that. But according to KHQ in Idaho, the resident of this home in Bonner Springs ended up shooting an intruder. This was on Sunday, July 19th. 21-year-old Sean Webster called police, said that he had shot a man who entered his home and threatened him before he fled the area and then called the police. When they got there, deputies found 50-year-old Jason Leroy Sparks dead in a bedroom at the back of the home, having sustained an apparent gunshot wound, according to KHQ. Investigators learned that Sparks had been working on the vehicle of his ex-wife, Ashley Sparks, at the home shared by Ashley and 21-year-old Sean Webster. According to sheriff's officials, Webster had received threats from Jason Sparks in the past. Witnesses in the area said they heard yelling at the home. And then just before 7 p.m., Jason Sparks reportedly entered the residence without invitation, behaving in an aggressive manner. Sheriff's office officials say that Sean Webster retreated to his bedroom, armed himself with a pistol. Jason followed Sean into the bedroom, grabbed him by the throat, and started to lift him off the ground. In response, Sean fired a single shot into Jason's neck, stopping the attack and ultimately killing Jason. Sheriff's officials say that Idaho's Castle Doctrine permits the use of deadly force against an unlawful intruder in your home, your workplace, or occupied vehicle. It removes the legal duty to retreat, although Webster apparently tried to do that, and establishes a presumption that you reasonably feared for your life when facing a forced unlawful entry. Webster was not arrested at the scene. Sheriff's office, though, says the investigation will be conducted by the Bonner County Prosecutor, evaluating any potential criminal charges against Webster. Again, somebody enters your home uninvited. They grab you by the neck. They try to lift you up. At that point, you're in legit fear for your life, right? So again, unless there are some extenuating circumstances that we don't know about, I think this is going to be ruled by the prosecutor there, a justifiable use of force. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more details. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing, a resident in Texas from the Kerrville area who saved his girlfriend, saved some neighbors, saved some dogs from the floodwaters that have been inundating the area. We've seen a lot of flooding here on the East Coast as well. We're doing okay where I am, but boy, West Virginia got hit hard. Some parts of the state got 4 inches of rain in a little more than an hour yesterday, so I know that there's been some significant flooding there as well. And down in Texas, a lot of the state dealing with flash floods and things of that nature. So this was last Wednesday, last Thursday. Matthew Jarrett and his girlfriend, Kat Van Kirk, they're lying in bed. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning, and they hear this crash. It sounded breaking glass. As it turns out, their sliding glass doors were blown out from the floodwater. Jarrett says everything flooded at once. In their home, he said his girlfriend's hair got caught up in some shelving and furniture. One of her dog's legs got stuck in the furniture that was now floating inside the home. He said once they got them free, they were unable to get through the front or back door of the home because of the, just the severity of the floodwaters. And he said the side door of the house had been blocked by the refrigerator, so they really had limited escape options. He said, I went through the bedroom window. I opened it up. I killed power to the outside AC unit. I tried getting onto the roof. He said, I tried getting my girlfriend onto the roof. Couldn't get her up there. He said, I had the dogs on the mattress that was floating. He said, I decided to walk around the side where the gate was blowing out and made it to the truck. He said, my truck started up. And then I started carrying each dog out first. I came back for his girlfriend last because she wouldn't leave without the dogs. Cat Van Kirk said, the water was like rapids. She said, I can't describe it any other way. She said, it wasn't running water. There were rapids coming through my backyard and the side yard. So after Jarrett was able to get the dogs and his girlfriend into the truck, Matthew Jarrett then went back and saved a neighbor. He said he never actually met her before. He said, I'd always seen her in the morning. She let her little chihuahua out. He said, I was worried about her. When he got to her home, she's sitting there on the couch. Water is rushing through her house as well. Matthew Jarrett said she had her dog in a carrier, and she had two sacks sitting there beside her. And I said, you're getting out of here. And I got her and the dog out. Cat Van Kirk said he checked the whole cul-de-sac, the whole neighborhood. As me and my dog sat in safety, he went around to each of these homes and made sure that everybody was able to get out. He told another neighbor that he could get the debris out from under the neighbor's truck. She said that she'd also try to get her car out of the driveway. And he said, I just looked at her and I said, what car? There's no car there. He said, I don't even know if they found the car yet. He said, I don't know. I don't believe they did. So, I mean, that tells you the strength of these floodwaters carrying a car away. Cat Van Kirk says if it wasn't for her boyfriend, she wouldn't be here today. And his neighbor across the street, a woman named Linda, ended up being taken to the emergency room via ambulance. He said, I don't know if Linda, or she said, I don't know if Linda would have made it. Cat Van Kirk said she's okay. She's getting some help. But now we've got these amazing people, friends and family that are helping. They're doing everything that they can, just keeping us in their prayers. He says it's going to be an extremely long, long road ahead of us. But I'm thankful for the people that have been able to help us through this. And, you know, sounds like they are going to suffer an extensive rebuilding process. But thankfully, thanks to the life-saving actions of Matthew Jarrett, they have a chance to rebuild their lives. So in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing for loved ones and for neighbors he'd never met. Matthew Jarrett, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with a friend, Toby Leary, from Cape Gunworks up in Massachusetts. There is so much to discuss there. Massachusetts gun law fails. We'll talk about the First Circuit decision upholding Massachusetts' ban on so-called assault weapons, a decision that I suspect is not going to be particularly long-lasting. And also, we've got the latest on the ballot initiative to repeal Chapter 135 in Massachusetts, the omnibus gun control bill that was passed 2 years ago, portions of which are still not in effect, portions of which are rolling out. And, you know, Toby and the Civil Rights Coalition instrumental in putting this repeal measure on the ballot. We now know what question it will be on the November ballot. There are a lot of referendums that are going to be on the ballot, but I think this one, it's got a ring to it. And we'll talk about that with Toby on tomorrow's program. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day today, that we are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation, including when New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and magazines might actually be wiped off the books now that we've got this Third Circuit decision. We've got a new lawsuit filed by the Firearms Policy Coalition we're paying attention to, and a whole lot more. So check it out at BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. You'll get some great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose. And again, no matter what tier you choose, you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms. And I greatly thank you for that. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.